This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Talking about race is never easy. Talking about inequality among racial groups and things start to get awkward. Putting all that in the context of schools and education, and congratulations, you've started an argument. The fact is, there is educational inequality in the U.S. for many reasons.
Historically, we've thought of schools as the vehicle for equalizing opportunity.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll have a conversation about race, culture, and inequality in two countries with very similar racial histories, the U.S. and South Africa. We'll also spend an academic minute in a galaxy far, far away. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. It's been over 57 years since the Supreme Court decision in the Brown versus Board of Education case, and the question of inequality in schools is still valid. A comparative study was recently done between schools in countries with relatively similar racial histories, the United States and South Africa. While that comparison may come as a shock to you, the similarities between the two countries are striking. Prudence Carter, an associate professor of education and sociology at Stanford University, spent countless hours in schools in both countries. The result is the book Stubborn Roots: Race, Culture, and Inequality in U.S. and South African Schools. We had a fascinating conversation about the state of equality in education in the U.S., and I asked if she thought people would be surprised at her inclusion of the South African system in the discussion.
Well, it depends on the population. Among my colleagues in the academy, perhaps, but maybe for the general public, it may be a bit surprising. And the reason why I wanted to do this is because we're in this now era in the human history where the lines between nation states, societies, or so are much thinner. And it's important to remember the history. South Africa and the United States and a few other countries are often compared to each other when it comes to sociological and economic and political issues because of the similarities in their origins, particularly the formation, slave formation states.
Well, given the context of history, both nations have been, you know, have gotten rid of slavery and apartheid, for that matter, relatively recently.
Well, in the scheme of human history, it's not been that long ago. I mean, South Africa's apartheid system was very similar in some ways to our Jim Crow system, a little bit more rigid, but somewhat similar. There are definitely convergences between the two systems. But I think that the biggest question for me when I went off to do this research was to try to kind of understand how a country like South Africa that became a democracy in 1994 was going to grapple with opening up its society and its schools in a relatively more progressive era of human history, of global history, of world history, and comparing that to a country like the United States, which started that process more than five decades ago. And also, given that the two countries have very different social compositions, South Africa is almost the exact converse of the U.S. It's a black majority country, which is about 79% African, and then it has a 10% white minority and various other groups in between. And the United States is the reverse. You know, it's a majority white country, as we know, with about 12 to 13% African American and other groups, about 13% Latino, and then smaller Asian populations and other groups.
Is it more accurate to take regions of the United States to make the comparison, since South Africa is so much smaller than the U.S.?
Well, and essentially that is what the study does. I chose intentionally to go into four cities, two in each country, which were similar to one another. So there are capital cities which have similar kind of racial ethnic orders or hierarchies in both countries, similar in size. So the cities were chosen selectively. And certainly from case studies of eight schools in both countries, you can't generalize about the entire country. But yeah, I certainly learned, my research assistants and I learned a great deal about how some schools operate in both societies. And certainly we believe that they're illustrative of how other schools may be working in those societies.
Are public schools our first line of defense against inequality? Or put it the other way around, are they our first line of offense to fight it?
Historically, we've thought of schools as the vehicle for equalizing opportunity. It's the vehicle for mobility for many groups who have been historically boxed out of those opportunities to advance in life. And so we do think of education because it is something that is for the people, of the people, and owned by the people, particularly public education. We've seen over the decades, over the generations, various groups become more mobile because they've improved their educational status. So that's what the way we think about it. But I caution any listener or reader to not put it all in the education basket, because one of the things that we do know, and it was clear from the study, is that education is also greatly linked to other parts of our society, the economy, the polity in terms of lawmaking and policies and rules and regulations, communities and neighborhoods. So they all work like an ecosystem. And that's really important to say. But certainly my focus here in this study was to figure out what schools could do in terms of their piece of the puzzle.
Schools have been integrated in the U.S. for, well over half a century now, so I'm sure a lot of people are saying, well, come on, problem solved.
Well, that's actually not true, Bob. Schools have not been integrated. Schools have been desegregated, and that's one of the biggest points of Stubborn Roots, is that desegregation is fundamentally, conceptually, and in practice different from integration. And that has not been more clear to me since I've gone back to high school in these two countries and spent a lot of time in diverse schools. Desegregation is a process whereby we place diverse bodies of students in schools together. You know, sometimes they're in classrooms, some together, and sometimes they're not. But we don't really, are not attended to really deeply engaging, incorporating all the kids and making sure that there are no inequalities that manifest in those schools. That's desegregation, just having the bodies in place. Integration is a much deeper, richer, and more complex process. That is about changing the environment, the ethos, the climate of the school in a way where there's a high expectation culture for all kids, that the educators and students are vigilant about making sure classes and extracurricular activities and governance reflect the full student population and parent communities, that there is more exchange and not palpable boundaries. One of the things that kids said to me repeatedly in this study is, yes, you can have segregation within so-called integrated schools, meaning you can have segregation within schools where there's a diversity of students, and that's because we have different practices in schools that keep kids cordoned off from one another. That could be through ability grouping or tracking. That could be through what we found, other things like kids and educators, sometimes because of the way the systems have run, tend to racialize or ethnicize, if you use ethnicity, different activities. So baseball pertains to one group, while basketball pertains to another group, while cheerleading pertains to another group in the U.S., and in South Africa, rugby was to one group as the soccer was to another group. And so those are ways where we see segregation really manifest in schools and really undermine the project of what we think of integration. And the final point I want to make about this is the problem has not been solved. If we look at some of the schools in the study who have been participating in voluntary desegregation programs for many years, for decades, there is a huge disparity in terms of the outcomes, whether it's college-going rates or whether it's participation rates and really kind of upper echelon, high-status programs between those who are more affluent and in the white majority versus those who are lower class and who are of color. And so that, in many ways, signals that we have not really solved the problem.
Is the problem a racial problem or an economic problem?
It's both. It's not an either-or, I argue, based on the research and the data here. It's both. In the South African case, what's really interesting is that the processes of desegregation really is more commonly happening among the middle class. And yet we're still seeing segregation. And let me explain what I mean by that. In the South African context, unlike the United States, students attend public schools but have to pay annual fees because there are not tax assessments on property values, and so the financing system is not the same. And so the more rigorous and the better resourced schools tend to be more middle and upper middle class schools. Now, those schools have really diversified in the last 15 years since democracy arrived, and those schools, however, can only be really afforded by those who are middle class and who are like maybe lower working class and upper class. And so the schools that I went into in the South African context that were diverse were those kinds of schools. And they were as good as any American school, in some cases may have been better, in terms of their resource context. At the same time, there was quite a bit of separatism and boundaryness in those schools that were quite shocking to us. I write a great deal about some of the things that we saw in those schools. So that ended up being more about race and ethnicity. And some people would say it could be about class, but if you say a social class is also a racial group, because in both countries, race and class are so inextricably linked given the histories and given who had access to opportunity and garnering more wealth. In the United States, in some of my schools, it was the case that there was a significant class difference between the kids of color and the kids who are white. But however, we control for socioeconomic status of families and still found significant differences by race. So I say it's both. It's not necessarily just one or the other.
Many schools now are graded by test scores, and they see great test scores, so they say, well, this school is not failing, this school is doing well. Does that miss the point of what you're looking at?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the biggest arguments of this work, and based on the students, I start the book with a debate among a group of boys who are attending a very well-resourced, an affluent school. They are part of a program that had been busing in lower-income African-American and Latino and even poorer white kids for 40 years. And these kids are debating the purposes of education. Some believe, like many of us, that the schools are just about imparting the knowledge we need to have the, you know, achieve the 3 R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic, right? But there are other kids who fundamentally believe that the notion of education had been narrowing and has been narrowing, that they were just becoming test scores, and that so that their worth, their sense of themselves were all wrapped up in this number. And I argue that, yes, the material context and the hard aspects of education are absolutely fundamental, but we're also finding to deeply engage certain kinds of kids in school, it's important to think about the civic aspects, the sociocultural aspects, and the political aspects of schooling. Even the social psychological aspects. So these kids were really forcing us to think about some of these issues and talking about why it is that some of them were becoming disaffected with schooling, because schooling was becoming less engaging, not dealing with a lot of the issues that they felt that mattered in society, and even not giving them access to some of the things that really have historically engaged kids, you know, from the arts to civics to, I mean, one of my schools, the kids realized that they needed to bring in a program to really think about how inequality manifests in society and in their neighborhoods, and then how that kept them from being good citizens from one another. So these are issues that are really relevant. They're harder to policy, and they're harder to practice, particularly if it means changing the mindsets of many people. And how do we do that? Because most of us are products of the environments in which we were born and grown up.
Still to come, our conversation with Prudence Carter continues with a look to the future. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1142. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Prudence Carter, Associate Professor of Education and Sociology at Stanford University, and the author of the book Stubborn Roots: Race, Culture, and Inequality in U.S. and South African Schools. Our conversation continues with a look to the future. With all the data and research about where we are, what does that tell us about where we need to go?
It's a bigger question. I can talk about it at a bigger level, and I can talk about it specifically within schools. One of the things that we do know is that schools And many schools are thriving, so it's not entirely problematizing everything here. But the schools that were working, according to the study, where we found kids to be more what I call culturally flexible, they were kids who were moving across boundaries, academic boundaries, moving across social boundaries, deeply engaged in the school. Those kids were in schools where it was apparent where the leadership was also very attentive and vigilant about making sure everything in the school represented the people in the school, not just certain groups. And so those were educators who had more of a radically inclusive kind of approach to education, and they didn't want to have the disparities that they hear about in the news, and they didn't want to become just another one of those schools. There are other schools, however, where the educators were either just, they acquiesced to the fact that there was difference and that there were disparities, and they just kind of focused on the kids who were doing well. And so a number of groups of students actually just floundered, not to say all members of those groups, but some. And then there were others who every now and then would kind of implement a program or have an assembly. They would talk about it, but it was generally superficial and it didn't go deeply. And so the finding here is, how can educators be vigilant? What we know from the South African context is there is a high, high expectation from all students. All high school students, for example, have to be proficient in at least two of the national languages. If you're in the same grade, you're expected to be exposed to the same curricula. They really talk about utilizing education as a transformative aspect of society. In the U.S., it's a little bit more difficult to practice that because we have 50 different accountability systems or more and thousands of school districts where everyone is doing their own thing. But what we do know is that kids who are in schools where tracking is correlated to class, race, and ethnicity, they're not faring as well. So that's a kind of a bigger picture. That's a kind of a within-school thing. The bigger picture issue is, and I go back to this notion of the ecosystem, our schools reflect our communities. And lots of kids right now are in under-resourced schools because they live in under-resourced communities. And that's about residential segregation, both economically and racially and ethnically. And that's something that requires not just educational officials to think about, but us as citizens to think about, because that's something that we have individual choice about.
It must be almost frustrating for people, because in the U.S., there's such a backlash against any federal mandates. It's everybody wants their own control of their own school system. And for the most part, that's good. But trying to put big issue, big picture programs in force, it's always a struggle.
Well, I think the biggest thing, Bob, is to think about our long-term interests. We can think individualistic in whether or not I have mine and my children have mine, or we can think about what's going to promote the health of the country. And I think that is a bind that many of us are in, that we as a nation are in at the moment. In the next 20 years or so, 20 to 30 years, the demographics of this country will have shifted drastically. And we want to understand in the United States whether or not we're going to have a very productive and economically viable society with educated citizens. If a number of those citizens are black and brown and come from poor backgrounds and they're underprepared, that's going to be a serious economic threat to our country. But more importantly, not as importantly, it's the fact of what our neighborhoods and communities are going to look like, what our workplaces, what our civic and social organizations are going to look like. And I fear that we could be headed in the direction of an economic and in another form of kind of a new age form of apartheid in this country, where a minority of the citizens really are taken care of, but the majority of the citizens are not. So it's something that should matter to all of us, because it affects our communities, it affects our economy, it affects how our nation is going to run. And if we're comfortable just with a minority of us being healthy and having what we need, then I think the rest of the world will look at us and shake their heads like they did somewhere around the 1940s and 50s when we were stuck in the Jim Crow era. So it's not a progressive way to move as a society. And so I'm thinking long-term and big picture. And it's interesting because high school students think about these things. Young people say a lot of incisive things based on their day-to-day interactions. I was quite enlightened by many of them. And we spoke to thousands in the course of this study.
It's interesting. It compared. You're really comparing the right now. There's like the wage gap, which is widening, and that's going to be an education gap, which will continue to widen with it.
and the digital divide gap, and yeah, there's so many. The wealth gap has gotten so big, and we now know from recent research, and one of my colleagues at Stanford has most recently shown that the educational gap, if we just look at test scores, has even widened between those who are in the 50th percentile income bracket, which is like a solidly middle class, and those in the 90th percentile. Now, it was already wide between those who were in the 10th and 90th, which were the poorest and the wealthiest, but we're seeing increasing divides because of wealth as in inequality. And so it's going to get compounded, I would project, if we don't start to think about how our schools can act and be more proactive and vigilant. But the schools can't do it without the support of the parents and communities. And many parents and communities right now are really struggling just because everyone's focused on making sure their own is taken care of. And maybe this is so idealistic of me as a sociologist, but we come together as a wonderful nation when there are catastrophes and there are tragedies. I wish even in times when we're not that we can really be forward-thinking about how we can build a better and healthier network among ourselves and take care of each other.
Prudence Carter is an associate professor of education and sociology at Stanford University. Her book is called Stubborn Roots: Race, Culture, and Inequality in U.S. and South African Schools. It's published by Oxford University Press. Okay, after a fairly heavy conversation about race and equality, I think it's time for a little fun. Star Wars! That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. 35 years after the release of the original film, the Star Wars series has captured the imagination of multiple generations. Carl Rubino, the Winslow Professor of Classics at Hamilton College, explains the story's myth-like appeal.
The Star Wars story, we are told, takes place, quote, a long time ago in a galaxy far away, unquote. One reason these films have been so popular is that they recall another such world, heroes with troubled parentage, tutors with mysterious powers, immense journeys that represent whole lifetimes, the eternal struggle against disorder and violence. All these themes are familiar to readers of the heroic sagas of ancient Greece and Rome. Star Wars fans love Yoda, the Jedi master who tutors Luke Skywalker on a remote planet. Fans of Greek myth will remember Chiron the Centaur, who lived in a cave on Mount Pelion. There he taught the young Achilles the skills of hunting, breaking horses, medicine, and music. Achilles also discussed the ancient virtues with his master, just as Luke does with Yoda. The struggle between Luke and Darth Vader reminds us of Oedipus, who did not know who his father was until it was too late. Luke, unlike his Greek predecessor, is able to redeem his father and reconcile with him. Films about ancient Rome, once a Hollywood staple, went into a long eclipse in the mid-60s, not to return until the appearance of Gladiator in 2000. During those years, however, inventive filmmakers found other ways to display Roman motifs. The Star Wars story, in which a motley crew of upstarts struggles against an evil empire, in quotes, provides an outstanding example of dressing up perennial themes in fancy new clothes. The Star Wars films bear witness to the enduring power of this ancient legacy, which has much to do with the secret of their appeal. Those ancient Greeks and Romans are not so far away from us as we might think.
That was Carl Rubino of Hamilton College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.